Hello and welcome to S75. This is Section, the evening of July the 9th. We're going to be doing a walkthrough for Project Zero and discussing some issues related to PHP, XML, and XPath. So the spec is up for Project Zero. If you go to s75.net, you can see it's up on the main page. S75.net. It's on the main page here, Project Zero specification. And a few of the instructions that I'm going to be doing tonight will be slightly different than your configuration because I haven't downloaded the latest version of the appliance yet. But I'm sure that we'll have an opportunity to confront some of the differences between what I'm doing and the current version of the appliance in future sections. So first of all, you'll want to create a Bitbucket account. So in the section labeled Bitbucket, you can see that it asks you to go to bitbucket.org/plans. And I actually don't have a Bitbucket account, so I'm going to sign up. You want to sign up for the free account. And it says to be sure to use a .edu address so that you're automatically upgraded to an unlimited student plan. And so I will use my name and click sign up. Doesn't look like there's any errors on the page. So now I have an unconfirmed email address, so I'll go to my email account and we'll probably have an email from Bitbucket asking me to confirm. There, now I've been confirmed. So if you go back to the Bitbucket instructions, the first new thing is to create a new repository. Create repository. And we want to put Project Zero under name. And we want a Git repository. And then we want both issue tracking and wiki under project management, if we like. I'm actually not going to do that because I'm not going to be using those features. Under language, we'll select PHP. And then we'll input a value for the description and the website if you'd like. I'll put Project Zero for CS75. So we created a repository. And then you should find yourself at a page whose URL includes your username and Project Zero. So I actually haven't finished creating this URL. Not going to enter a website because this isn't going to be live on the internet. So here's my username and my Project Zero. The first thing you want to do is set up SSH. And so if you go to your SSH directory, you can see I already have an id_rsa.pub key. And that is what you will create by doing SSH key gen. So I already have this RSA pub key, and in order to get that pub key, you want to use genie. And then you'll go into your Bitbucket account paste the key into the field called SSH keys. So in account, SSH keys. Here's my whole SSH key. You want to copy the whole line with no new lines. So don't copy the new line if you can. And paste it in, add key. It looks a lot like GitHub. This interface here is probably somehow related to GitHub. So now we want to create our initial commit into the repository. So this is the part that will be slightly different for me than for people running the appliance. So the equivalent of the vhosts directory for me is the public HTML directory, which is the directory where I will store all of my public-facing HTML files. If I go into public HTML, then I will... let's see if they already had you... make a directory called public, or called project zero. And you can see that it doesn't have the right permissions. I need at least 7.11 permissions in order to be able to execute code in that directory. And in order to make it a little bit more friendly to view online, I'm going to give it a little bit more generous permissions. So I'm going to chmod 755 project zero. And then I have a project zero directory, and this project zero shows up. Now let's go back to the walkthrough. I'm inside of the project zero directory, inside of the directory that will let you show your HTML on your localhost browser. And these commands here are not, they're not necessary, it's not necessary for you to be in this directory, at least for the config global. But I will do git init, and it says initialized empty git repository. And then I will say git add hyphen hyphen all and git commit dash m initial commit. Okay, so you can see that it says one file changed and one insertion and zero deletions. So git is a source code manager. I've talked about git in previous sections. There are some resources about Git in the project Project Zero PDF. One of my favorite Git resources for beginners is if you go to the S75 sections page where I store my code on GitHub. you'll see down here that there are a lot of Git resources. And one of my favorite videos is a UE Theater video where it really runs you through the different workflows for Git. And in general, I'll just give you the feel for it. So we'll do So you can see here that the project zero background is red because I specified this attribute, bg color equals red. And if I, let's say I want to work on a new feature, then I can do git branch or git checkout b. Let's start working on the new feature called blue. And if I say git branch, you can see now that there's a star next to blue indicating that I now have the blue branch checked out. And each branch is literally a separate branch in your code that separate the different features that you're working on at one time, and then later on you can merge them together. So now I can go into the index and change the background color to blue and refresh it here, and it'll be blue. And if I do git add a, that's a synonym for git add hyphen hyphen all like we did before. If you do git status, it shows you that the index.php is modified and it's not staged for commit. So right now, since there is nothing in this section of the git status message, nothing would actually be committed if I were to make a commit right now. In order to stage that modification, I can do git add a index.php. Now if I do git status, you can see changes to be committed includes the modifications, such as making this blue. Then you can do a commit, git commit finished blue feature. This is my nice commit message. And now I'll do git branch, and I can see I'm still on the blue branch. If I do git checkout master, now it says switch to branch master, and you can see this directory is white, or this background is white. And if I do vim index.php, you can see that that background color is not even present here. But if I do git merge blue and then refresh the page, now it's blue. So basically what it did is it took the code from the blue branch and it merged it in, tracking where all the insertions and deletions were in each of the subfiles. So what this enables you to do is work on keep your master branch clean as of your latest good working version, and then you do git checkout b. -b and then feature name. and that will switch you to a brand new branch called feature. And then you can continue working on that feature, and then at any time, you can go back to the working version and get it. So now let's finish setting up Bitbucket, because you'll see the true value of Git once Bitbucket is set up. So we've made an initial commit. I'm gonna make this nice and big. And you can see this is the command we're going to be working on right here. Git remote add origin git at bitbucket.org. And then you want a colon. And then do your username, pnori/project0.git. And that should be, if you that should be this project. Git, yeah, see, git at bitbucket.org/pnori/project0.git. And then git push u origin master. The very first time you'll have to say, yes, I do want to commit, or I do want to acknowledge that domain is trusted. And now if we visit our source code will appear here. Oh yeah, you're right here. So this should be, okay, so now I've messed it up. So basically your code will appear on Bitbucket after you push if you don't misspell git get at bitbucket.org. If as long as you keep doing git commit and then git push, then the most recent version of your code will always be stored online. And what that will mean is that at any time you can delete your entire directory and then do git clone and then your Bitbucket URL, and you'll be able to download the most recent version of your code from online, which will provide you some insurance in case your appliance goes corrupt or something. After you have git configured, then you'll want to start thinking about how to encode the menu in XML. We've already talked a little bit about how to do XML in PHP. Specifically, in last week's lecture, we talked about how to parse RSS, and David talked a little bit about that in his lecture. If you were here last week and you saw the section about working with Model View Controller in PHP, we created a simple model of a blog using an RSS XML as a data storage mechanism. And this is what that blog looked like. It has only one controller element, only one user interface element, which is that you can press next buttons until you get to the end of the posts, and then it grays out. And then you can press previous buttons until it gets to the end of the posts, and then it grays out. And all of the information from each of these blog posts and the blog title and the blog subtitle is stored in an XML file. So you can see that the context for this application divided up model, view, and controller into three separate folders. You can get a nice directory tree like this in ASCII using the tree command in Linux. Which gives you a nice printout. And so in MVC in general, how the flow of MVC goes from one file that's the entry point to the controller. The controller makes a request to the model, and the model it interacts with the data storage mechanism and then passes the data back to the controller. And the controller then does any final formatting that's necessary and prepares the data to be sent off to the appropriate view, where the view that the user sees is rendered. And in this case, this is the order of execution. So you can see that there's a separation between the controller and the model, and the controller and the view and the controller. The controller is kind of the cement that binds it all together. If we go into the model data.xml, you will have to invent your own XML schema for Project Zero. I chose my own. I chose RSS because it's already a well-known XML format for doing blog things. And the model in this case parses this XML file and renders each of these blog sections and provides the information necessary to gray this out if there are no previous blog posts. If we go to So the first point of entry is the controller, which is up top. The data structure here, I've created an array of like queries basically to query the model with. And each of these is a variable that I want to be filled in with some kind of data. And when you're using MVC, you want your model to be separate from your controller. And the idea is that a team that's halfway across the country could be working on the model, and they could be coding all of the business logic into the model, and then you could be coding on the controller, and then at the end you'd be able to hook it up together. So it's important to have an interface that enables you to keep a separation between the model and the controller. That just helps you write clean code. In this case, these variable names are variable names that I know that the model supports. And this is slightly different from the version of the application that I presented last time, where I actually put queries right in the controller. If you look at So here the controller is 65 lines long, and here it's only 31 lines long. In general, if you find your controller inflating with logic, like notice here I have to do an if call, you know, if you have lots of logic inside of your controller in order to just render the data necessary that for the view, then you might have what's called a fat controller, which is a good sign that you need to move some of that data back to the model. And the model in this application uses XPath, which is an XML query language, as David mentioned, in order to access each of the variables. So for each of these variables, like posts to display, it gets passed into the model, and down here, I iterate through each of the queries, and if a function exists with the query name, like each one of these is an associative array, we have post number to display goes to, and then a string of length 0. If a function exists called post to display, then I use a function call user func to call the function with that name and with the parameters indicated here. In this case, no parameters or default parameters. So for each of these queries, down here, as long as I create a function with the same name as the query and then return the value that is supposed to enter in here, then after the model is included, then now the data variable will actually include the this same data array, except the data will be filled in by the model. So if I comment out the two lines that were in front of this echo comment, which is going to print recursive the data variable, you can see that it's filled in the posts to display variable with the appropriate data. So the way that has worked is that I've stored a query here in post to display that is an XPath query. Here the query is, let me get the data open, APO6.
Yeah. That I looked into the problem and talked to some of my coworkers. We don't really know how to fix it right now.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine. Thank you. Yeah. So this particular query is the RSS. It seeks the RSS element, and then it seeks the channel element, and then it seeks the item element, and then it applies a filter to that where the position XPath method is equal to a digit. And the digit here defaults to 1. But here I find it really useful to look at the simple XML or to the notes that I've put on XPath in README. So Stylus Studio's XPath reference, this page here is at the bottom of my S75 sections page. This reference for Stylus Studio is a great reference for the XPath functions that are available to you and to just the general syntax of an XPath query. So here they're showing you that like this query would select the parachildren that have an attribute of type equal to warning. So when you're designing your XML structure, you want to think about making a structure that's easy to query with the XPath that you understand. Let's get out and let's look at menu.xml. So this is a simple menu, and so the way that you get to the point where you can actually read in the XML and conduct XPath queries on it, you have to use simple XML load file. That's it. Let's just do a print R on this to begin with. And simple XML element load file. So this file is in the same directory as menu.xml. So let's take a look at what this looks like. It should be the same file, actually. So you can see if I do a print R, it doesn't look very great on the top. So let's actually echo pre. All right, so simple XML load file returns a six simple XML element object. And inside that object is an array, an associative array, it's iterable, but the comment property goes to another simple XML object, and the pizza's property of the simple XML object goes to another simple XML object. So in order to access, let's do, if we do XML pizzas item, this one is called tomato and cheese. In simple XML element, or in the simple XML element class, it's more tricky to get a hold of the attributes, which is why you might want to stay away from them. And instead go because now we can descend into this element. Like that. So here I called forth the tomato and cheese element by being able to descend into this. And each one of these on the menu, you're going to have to kind of take a look at the menu and figure out how it is that you want to break it up. You only have to do a few from each section, you'll want to think about how to uniquely identify each of these, because somehow you're going to have to pass information about, you know, this exact purchase that's going to be passed over to the server, and it needs to be able to identify that element is actually the large broccoli pizza. So here we could do pizzas item name equals and then we could do a price element, or we could do a size element. If we do a price element, then we're just going to have to do large or small. And you could dispense with the price altogether. Let's see, what is the broccoli? $10.85. Here's another issue. Let's parse the, let's say that you have pizza name to get in a variable. We want the broccoli one. Then you could do item. You could execute an XPath query on this with the XPath method, and you could say pizzas item name equals and let's see what that gives us. So let's put another one in here just to make sure that we're not getting the wrong one. That's another one. Tomato and cheese. That one's cheaper, $9.75. Okay, we're still getting the correct, assuming that you have the name of the pizza here and you already know that you're getting pizzas, we're getting the right pizza element here. Let's say that we have pizza size in a variable, and it contains either the word large or the word small. Then you could do So now the pizza we want is indicated, or this array or this result right here with a single element that is now available inside the pizza we want variable. So if we wanted to get at the pizza size that we did, then we should be able to. Do a pizza we want, and this is an array, so we have to do zero. We have to iterate into the array in order to get the first object out. It just so happens that there's only one result. You might want to find out how many XPath results there are, in which case you'd want to do count of the array. And in this case, it'll do one because there's only one result. And if we want to get at the, let's put the small size in just so that we know we're getting the right one. So for broccoli, it's 685. And we want to get at the pizza size. And it echoes out 1085. So now what if you wanted to get two of these and then print that out? If I do this, if I get 1085 times 2, I get 20. So there's something funky going on there, and it has to do with the type conversion. When you get things out of XML, they have to be converted into the form that you want to use it in PHP. So let's say that we want to store it as a float. Okay, so now we get a better answer. You can see it's 21.7. But floats are approximations. And that's a big problem with money if you're approximating with cents. Now, granted, with a pizza restaurant, you're probably not going to get into the quantities where it's really going to matter. But when you're building things for clients, you should assume that it's really important for you not to mess with their money. So in this case, it might actually be smart for you to think twice about storing this as a float and dealing with it as a float. floats are always approximations. They're always one number divided by another number. And it's what you're getting is the number that's closest to whatever that is. And if you add enough of them together, eventually you'll get a rounding error. You might get two numbers that add up to 10.99 instead of adding up to 11. So instead, what we could do is store it like this in pennies. Because pennies are quantifiable. And then at the point where we actually display it out to the screen, we can still divide it by 100 and still get 21.7. And at this point, you might be wondering, how do you get it to format the right way? In some of the model code for this section, app model, so this function sprintf is often used to format strings. You can also use number format. Which takes a number and then a number of decimals. So let's try that. Okay, so now we need the dollar sign. If you put it in single quotes, the dollar sign will appear as you want. If you put it in double quotes, then you'll kind of confuse PHP a little bit, but it'll probably be okay, because when you use double quotes, it interpolates it. So actually here, I shouldn't be using double quotes. I should be using single quotes, because every time you use double quotes on a string, PHP wastes a few clock cycles trying to see if there is a variable in there that it needs to interpolate. But let's see if this works. Yeah, that works okay. So now you can display the total out to the screen. But if you do all your math in terms of pennies, then you'll never get any rounding errors or anything like that. You might want to use the seal function in order to get to the ceiling if you're rounding things. You might want to get to the floor function if you want to round to the floor. In general, you're going to have to somehow create a way to display the menu, and then make a way for a user to select an item and pass a unique identifier of that item to the user or to the server. And one way that you can do that is by passing each of these parameters as get parameters. So you could do level 1 equals pizzas, and level 2, or you could even, since each of these is a separate category, you could say, instead of calling this pizzas, you could just get rid of the item. And instead call this pizza. Now you have a really, really simple categorization. where when you're displaying the pizzas menu, you can pass in the menu name and then pass in the name of the element you want to select and then the relevant price. And you'll have to keep track using the session variable. You'll have to keep track of what is stored in the user's cart. You can go back to previous sections code if you want to see a few examples of that. In 627, we talked about session. In here, you can go through these examples in order to see how to use the session variable. The basic gist of it is that you need to call session start at the very top of the code, and since you're going to be using templates, you'll want to do this in one template and then include that in all of the pages that the user sees, so that all of the users don't see each other's carts. One little thing to think about is that the session, the way the session works is that it's literally a folder on the server that is named like a long number, and that long number equals a number that is stored on the user's computer in a cookie that is sent along with the request to the server. And so if you think about every single user having a different number and a different folder on the browser, then you'll see that you probably don't want to store the menu in the session variable. Because essentially, then what you'll be doing is for user 123, you'll store a menu. And then for user 124, you'll store the same menu. And so there'll be a lot of storage duplication if you do that. Instead, you should think of a way to generate the views from the XML in real time. Or cache them in some other way. So that you aren't unnecessarily burdening the server with the details of the menu. Let's see. I wanted to show you a few different XPath tools. So if you go to github.com/codekiln/s75-sections, you can get all of the code for each of the sections. And then down here under XPath, there are a few different tips. You can use this add-on called Scraper in order to test out XPath. So you'd open up Chrome and you'd say Add to Chrome. And then I have all these. Oh yeah, I messed with the source. Okay. So what Scraper is good for is that if you come to a page like this, which has the list of all the postal abbreviations, and let's say you were working on a project where you needed a drop-down list that had all of the postal codes in it, and you wanted your users to select the postal codes. Then if you have the scraper extension installed, you can right-click on an element and say scrape similar. And you can see it gives you a good guess of the XPath that lets you scrape all of those postal abbreviations. Here you can see kind of what it's doing, Alabama AL, ALA dot, ALA dot 01. That's just reading this very first row. But if you press Control Shift C and examine the element, you can guess that it's always going to be the second table data element in this table that contains these postal abbreviations. So maybe you could say you want just the second one. And then you realize that it already has a predicate limiting you to the very first table row. So now when you remove that predicate, you get all of the states. And you can copy from there into a tool like Notepad++. And here, you can use regular expressions to clean up the text. If you select regular expression in Notepad++, you're able to use regular expression keywords like /W is a non-word character. You can see there are a couple of those. And then I could do a digit character followed by a digit character that may or may not be there, followed by another non-word character. And if I replace all of those by nothing, now I have all of my abbreviations and a few extras because it includes like minor outlying islands and stuff like that as well. So at this point, you could paste it into your PHP code and make a select where each of these is an option that you could drop down. Another example of using scraper, you can, if you are on a rating site, and here they make it pretty hard to just get a list of all the people. They have it here in the page, but if you wanted to actually make a list of each of these people, you'd have to type it out one by one or copy it out one by one. And if you select here and do scrape similar, it gives you a guess. But if you look at the source code, you can see that they've really obfuscated it. They've put tables within tables within tables. So if you go down and you notice that the TR here, the table row, has a height of 30, then now you could... search for, if you do 2/ that means all elements where this matches. So I'm going to look for the TRs. All of the TRs in the document would return tons and tons of TRs. And you can see some of them are in there. We want a subset of that. We want the TRs where there's an attribute height equal to 30. And now you have the same list. You can copy it and paste it into Notepad++ and clean it up. Here I'll do another regex example. We'll do a non-word character followed by a digit, followed by another possible digit, followed by a non-word character. Let's see how far that gets us. Now we have another digit, followed by a literal period, followed by another non-word character. And I believe there's another digit. The question mark means 0 or 1 of these. So now we've got that. So now you have your list. If you wanted to do a quick blog post about that or whatever, or do a Google search on each of those. So Scraper is a great way to practice your XPath skills. In fact, you can even open up the XML for your menu in your browser. You'll have to make sure that it has the right permissions. So if you do ls-l, you can see it is not world readable. So we'll chmod 644 menu.xml. And now we'll go back to the sections. And menu.xml is here. You can see that it doesn't have any style information associated with it. Here, if you press Control-Shift-C, this is not the raw XML by any means. I was thinking that you'd be able to actually use XPath right on the thing, but it doesn't look like you'll be able to. But I did want to point out that the XPaths that you're able to get in Scraper, you are also able to get at using this search elements dialog in Chrome. So if you click here and right-click, like let's say we right-click on this A element, this anchor element that is for the PHP manual, and you do copy XPath, and then do search elements and paste it in, and maybe remove some of the predicates, then you can flip through the different matches. Here's the introduction match. And it gives you a good guess. Here we have the star operator, which matches any element. And then we're putting a predicate on ID equals left bar. And then whatever element has an ID attribute equal to left bar, we're looking at the elements that have a UL child and an LI child, and then finally an A child. So you'll get pretty comfortable with XPath in this assignment. Hopefully you will. If you don't do something terribly workaroundy, you will. And so do you guys have any questions about XPath or XML in PHP? I think we've covered everything that you basically need to know. We're going to be online answering questions and stuff as well. Yeah.
So we will be developing the project, and we are also going to add the feature, like, you know, if I select one small pizza and one sub, so at the end should I have to display, like, okay, total cost for the project? So
yeah.
Yes,
so the question was, does the spec include the requirement that you have an ability to see your entire cart before you check out? And I haven't read the latest version of the spec in detail, but I believe it does. Previous years have had that requirement. And so you'll want to make a page that enables you to see the contents of your cart, and that enables you to add things to your cart and subtracts things from your cart before checking out. That's a good question. And let's just take a look at that file.
So that means I will be writing the categories in the XML, and PHP will be rendering this category and display it, and then I will have to put the ability, the same ability, add in the item in the PHP itself, right?
So the question was, so the general format of the project is to create a categorization of the menu in XML, and then to use PHP to pull the information from the XML and then display it out to the page, and then use PHP's session functionality in order to store the information about the cart that the user is interacting with through separate page requests, and then finally providing them with the ability to check out and clear their cart. Is that kind of, you were just trying to clarify the process? Yeah, that's generally it. Can you say the last part? Whatever you selected, what?
Let's say I deserted 2-3 items and I logged out. When I'm logging back, should have to display last time you selected these other items?
Mm-hmm. So the question is, should I make it so that you can select several items and then log out and then log back in and then still have those items selected? And the answer to that is that you don't have any logging in or logging out functionality in this application. If you want to do that, that's above and beyond the spec. The spec is only to implement the cart. So in this case, this application is kind of a trivial e-commerce site, because in a real e-commerce site, we would be gathering credit card information. And you wouldn't want to gather credit card information without confirming a user's email address and stuff like that. And you probably won't want to go that far in this assignment because the details of sending mail through a server that's running on your own computer and getting it to actually arrive in a real email inbox, that's pretty complicated and that's beyond the scope of this project. It can be done, but it's a more complicated development situation than we really have the time to deal with. Does that pretty much? Yeah. So there's so much to work with here. If I was going to sit down tonight with a student who didn't know where to start, I would say first, develop your menu XML. Develop a menu XML. Don't develop the entire menu. Just develop a menu XML that has like 10 items in it or something. So and then render menu. And then render way to select items, and then add ability to put in cart, and then from there I would add the ability to check out. And what checkout means in the case of this assignment is telling the user, you have purchased this amount, it will be billed to your email account or to your credit card or whatever. And then you should call session destroy. And clear the session so that if they go through another purchase, they'll be able to fill up their cart again. And once you get to this point where you're actually able to render 10 items and render a way to select them, add an ability to put in the cart, and then check it out and call session destroy, then you can add a few more items for edge cases. And you know, so step 6 would be iterate and inflate the menu and change the rendering for the bugs that you get when you inflate the rendering. And if you can close this circle at least once before you get to the point where you're trying to render all the different categories and dealing with all the subtle things, you won't. You will get a lot farther, and you will understand the scope of the project before, because you know you can get really, really involved with the menu if you want to, and it's best not to get hung up at any one of the steps. So it's 7:25. I think that's probably as much as we have time for tonight. Is there any more questions? If not, we can take them offline. So good luck on the project. Get started tonight, tomorrow. The 18th is just a little over a week away. So that means that, you know, if you can close this loop by Friday and get the questions to us on Saturday, then you can spend the next 3 days kind of trying to figure out the submission process and trying to figure out the permissions on the server and all of those, like, kind of tricky things. You should allocate, if you've never worked with Linux before, you should probably allocate, like, at least 15% of all of your time to deployment. If not more, maybe 20 or 25%. The very first time you deploy to the assignments in this class, you'll find that is really hard. And that is not unlike real life. When you actually deploy a website, it is usually not painless. It's usually a tricky process. So in general, with web development projects, you should allocate at least 15% of your time to deployment. Unless it's a huge project, in which case 15%, you know, it's only going to take a fixed amount of time, probably. So, all right, that's about everything. Thank you for your attention, and thank you for your patience with our technical difficulties. We'll attempt to get them resolved before next week. Thanks so much.